Patty from White Rose Friday Night, York, PA.
Hi, my name is Patty Burke, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, Patty. My sobriety date is June 10th, 2002. I have a sponsor. His name is Steve Farnsworth. He knows he is my sponsor. I have a home group. Like he said, it's White Rose. It's the best home group in Pennsylvania. We meet Friday night at 8 o'clock. I have a position in that home group, which I've had for a very long time, probably like 10 years, but I am passing it off. I'm the speaker getter. So there's always a message of hope at my home group. You know, we get speakers up and down the East Coast, and so there's always a message of hope. So if you're ever in York, Pennsylvania on Friday night at 8 o'clock, stop on by. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you, what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it's given me a brand new life, not a patched up old life. And for that, I'll be forever grateful. And I don't know if I'll ever be able to pay Alcoholics Anonymous back for what it's done for me and my family and my children and my grandchildren. But I suit up and I show up and I do the very best to pass on what was passed, was freely passed on to me. And some days I'm really good at it and some days I'm not. And but I know one thing. That absolutely passing this on absolutely has saved my life many, many times, you know, because it's really hard to think about two things at the same time. So I can't think about myself when I'm trying to help somebody else. So, I mean, it's really like the saving grace. And I was born and raised in New Jersey, Irish Catholic, and that just says it all, you know what I mean? And I had a dad who was a drunk, and he was amazing. He was absolutely fabulous. He was so funny and sarcastic, and I loved him. The first person I ever felt connected to my whole life until I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was probably because we suffered from the same spiritual illness. I had a mother who didn't drink, you know, she took care of the house, the kids, you know, all that stuff, and I never wanted to be anything like my mom, and I was nothing like my mom. I don't have a lot of memories of growing up. I have two older brothers and a younger sister, and I don't remember them at all. I mean, I don't remember them at all. So I was self-centered from the very beginning. The only memories I have is when I'd hang out with my dad. And he would, like, take me to the bar, and it'd be dark and smoky, and the jukebox would be playing. And in a couple of years, these young people won't even know what the hell I'm talking about when I say that. You know what I mean? But I loved it, you know, and I was terrified my whole life. The only time I wasn't terrified is when I was with my dad, you know. And I was afraid to go to school, you know. I was, like, literally frozen with fear. Like, the teacher literally had to pick me up and carry me around, you know what I mean? Because I was just so terrified, you know. My whole life has been driven by fear. And I didn't know those words, and I didn't know how to put words to that way back then. But today, as I look back and I examine my life, I know exactly, that's exactly how my whole life has been. And even sometimes today, you know. But I just couldn't, like, function. Like, I really wish I would have started drinking in kindergarten. Because my life was hard in kindergarten. My head was constantly attacking me. You know what I mean? I just felt different than everybody, you know. And sometimes even when I drank, I still felt different than everybody else, you know. But then I just didn't give a shit. So I didn't start drinking until I was 14 years old, you know. So from kindergarten to 14 was really hard on me, you know. But my first experience with, well, my dad would drink like all night long. I'd get up in the middle of the night. And he'd be watching these black and white movies, and I would get up, and I'd get him a beer, and I'd pop it open, and drink as much as I possibly could till I got into the living room. And I don't remember the effects produced by alcohol, but I know I did it just about every single night. But my first time I got drunk, it was my best friend. She went to her cousin's over the weekend, and we met Monday morning at the bus stop, and she said, I drank this weekend. And she said, and we can't wait. We got to go now. We can't wait for the weekend. And I was like, all right, you know, and we jumped on a bus and we cut school and we went to Jersey City and we started to drink. And what happened is I experienced my very first spiritual awakening. I started to drink. I became comfortable in my own skin. I could look you in the eyes. I could care less what you thought about me because I constantly thought people were thinking about me. You know, I could breathe easy. You know what I mean? I became extremely seductive. My clothes came off and I went into a blackout. And that's how I drank from the very beginning to the very end. Alcohol was so powerful and so freeing for me that I was naked. And it wasn't like I had this, like, fabulous body. Because my whole life, I've always looked like SpongeBob. I was square and flat with skinny legs, you know what I mean? And I did not care. That's how free it made me, you know? And I found something that day that worked. And And I was just amazed, like, how free my head was, you know what I mean? And I was never going to wait for anybody ever to offer me alcohol ever again. I lived up the street from this liquor store, and I would take my lunch money every single day, and I'd get old men to buy me alcohol. So I was a daily drinker from the very beginning, and I had to. And you know, I suffered a lot of consequences, because when you're 14 and naked and blacked out, you get in a lot of trouble, and I did not care. It was well worth it for me to be okay and comfortable in my own skin, even if it was only for a brief moment, and of course, I'd overshoot that mark. But I remember, like, it was Memorial Day weekend, and I was 14 years old, and I stood out in front of the liquor store, and I got some old guys to buy me alcohol, and I went to the beach, right? And I was roaming around the beach, and I was probably a little bit seductive at this point in my little venture through the beach. And I ran into these guys, and these guys said to me, "Do you want to come drinking with us?" And I was like, "Absolutely. When you're drinking on lunch money, yeah, I want to go drinking with you." So I jumped in a car, right, with these two guys who I had no idea who they were, nor did I care. All I knew was that I was going to be drinking, right? And what happened that day absolutely changed my world. And what happened that day is I wound up getting brutally beaten and raped. Does not make me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic? I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. Once I put any alcohol in my body, it sets off a phenomenon of craving. And once I start, I can't stop. And when I do stop, all I do is think about it until I pick it up again. But this day I became a victim, right? And I convinced my mother that if you were raped at the age of 14, that you would need to drink. And my mother just was devastated and did not know what to do. And so she agreed with me. So at a young age, I was allowed to drink, not the way I wanted to, but I was allowed to drink. And I really believe that I didn't have any suicide attempts throughout high school because I was allowed to drink, and it stopped my head a lot. And they started sending me to psychiatrists. I'm telling you, I went to hundreds of psychiatrists, therapists, counselors, you know what I mean? They started saying stuff like that. I was very depressed, and they started putting me on medications. And they would say stuff to me like, "Now, Patty, if you drink on this medication, it's going to triple the effect of alcohol." I was like, "Oh my God, that's amazing. Yes, I'll take the meds," you know what I mean? Because I'm drinking on lunch money here, you know? And so, and I was just a mess, you know what I mean? I was out of control, you know what I mean? Such a disaster. And I barely made it out of high school. I graduated high school at the age of 18 with a note from my psychiatrist saying if I didn't graduate with my class, I'd have a breakdown. And they just really wanted to get me the hell out of that school, you know what I mean? Because I was a mess, you know? And so I graduated high school, walked across that stage drunk out of my mind, and fell off that stage, and my mother was not impressed, you know. And so when I when we got back home, my father said to me, he said, "Patty, it's time for you to go. You're 18 years old, you graduated high school, we did our part, it's time for you to leave." And I was like happy, I was like, all right, and I left home, and I moved in with a go-go dancer, right? And I was supposed to watch her son while she danced that night, and what happened is, my life became very unmanageable because I didn't have my mother to manage my life. And I started to get DUIs and I started to get arrested. And I started to feel like I didn't even have a reason and purpose for living anymore except to drink. You know, and I couldn't go to college. You can't go to college when you graduate high school with no credits, with a note from a psychiatrist, you know. And I never, ever wanted to be married. But what I always wanted to do was be a mom. So I came up with a plan that what I really need to do is have a baby. Because if I have a baby, I'll have a reason and purpose for living. I'll have someone to always love, someone to always love me. And so that's what I did. I set out to get pregnant. And I went to this party, and there was this really dumb guy there. He's still dumb today. And I feel bad for him. But he was really dumb, right? But he was really cute. And so I found his name out, and I called him. I said, "Let's go get in the car," you know what I mean? And I dragged him off, and we were together, and I got pregnant, right? And my mother was devastated, you know, being Catholic, you know. She was very devastated a lot by my actions, you know what I mean? And so she thought it was best if I married this guy. And this is how my dad describes me. My dad said that if I was in Shea Stadium, and the stadium was filled with brain surgeons, that I'd pick up the hot dog vendor. And he was definitely like a hot dog vendor. And so one of my many, many psychiatrists, one of them just happened to be a reverend, so my psychiatrist married me, right? And so now I'm married to this hot dog vendor, right? And I'm pregnant, and I have this little girl that I love with all my heart and soul. And tomorrow she'll be 32 years old. And I don't even like this guy. Like, I don't hate him. I just don't like him, you know what I mean? He's, like, dumb. And so he got a job one day, right? I think it's the only time he's ever had a job, right? And he went off to work, and I rolled. I took my little girl, and I left, you know? And I took off to California, got to California, and I realized, wow, I have nobody to watch my daughter while I drink. So I came back to Jersey, right? And I tell you, and I really did, all as I wanted to do was to be the best mom. And really, my little girl never had a mother. I was never, ever there. I'd drop her off with the hot dog vendor, and I go off and I drink, you know what I mean? Because he didn't work, you know? And at the end of the year, I'd get a really big income tax check because now I have a kid, and what I would do is I would go off on vacation and leave that little girl behind, you know, because I deserved it, and that hot dog vendor's not doing anything anyway, so he can watch her. And so I got to go to a lot of places. I don't really remember seeing a lot of anything. They definitely seen me wherever I was, you know what I mean? But I do remember the one year when I was vacationing in Southern California, I met this really, really hot Marine. And he was stationed in Southern California, and he was from Minnesota. And he was, like, really athletic. And what I wanted to do was to impress him, just like I wanted to do with everybody, because this is how I am without a drink in me. I am so scared, and I don't know who I am, and I don't even know what I like. You know what I mean? And I like whatever you like, you know, and I'll do whatever you do, you know what I mean? Because I don't know who I am. And so he's athletic, and he's into these winter sports because he's from Minnesota, and he's into, like, skiing and ice hockey and all that crazy shit, you know what I mean? And I am not athletic whatsoever at all. Like, my mother did sign me up for soccer when I was in second grade, and they took me off the field, and they're like, you're in charge of handing out oranges. So that's just describes, like, how athletic I am, right? But he doesn't know that, right? You know what I mean? And so what I did tell him is I told him that I'm an expert skier, right? Because he lives in California and I live in Jersey, and how could I possibly get caught lying? And I just want him to like me. And so I got back to Jersey, and he really did like me, because when he called me and he said to me, he said, Patty, I'm going to come to Jersey and I'm going to take you skiing in Vermont. And I thought, oh my God, that is amazing, because I never drank in Vermont before. Right? And so my big plan was to get him good and loaded, because I've never skied ever. To this day, have I ever skied? But so we get to Vermont, and he really wants to ski. And I told him I'm an expert skier, so now we're going up this expert hill, and I am, like, shaking. I don't know if anybody's ever skied, but it is really, really, really high. And I am, like, shaking. He's like, are you all right? I said, I just haven't skied in a while, you know? So we get all the way up to the top, and it's really, really high. And I don't know how to get off a ski lift. I barely got on a ski. I've never skied in my life, you know what I mean? I don't even know how to get off this ski lift, right? So what I do is I fall off, and I get tangled up and wrapped around the poles, you know what I mean? They have to shut down the whole ski lift to untangle me, you know what I mean? The expert skier. And so I said, you know what? I said, you go ahead and ski, and I'll meet you down at the end of the mountain. So he goes off skiing because he skis. And I took, I climbed, crawled, rolled. You can't even imagine what I did to get 4 hours to down. That's how hot, 4 hours to down the bottom of them. That's how high it is. And he would ski past me because he skis, you know what I mean? And, like, and if I wasn't, like, already on the ground, I would throw myself on the ground and give him a little pose, you know what I mean? And I tell that story because that's a perfect example of how I get myself jammed up because I'm a liar. And I don't know who I am, and I'm just trying to impress people. And so what happens throughout my life, every time I start getting really arrested a lot again, what I think is I need one more baby. If I have one more baby, I'm going to be okay. See, I didn't know that I had something that no human power could cure. I thought if I had the right guy or enough kids, I'd be okay. So by the time I'm pregnant with my third daughter, I cannot stop drinking. And my first two pregnancies, I didn't drink at all. So I do know this is a progressive illness. And every day I would try so hard not to drink. And I would hear stuff like, it's good to drink wine when you're pregnant. And I would think, what the hell's the difference between wine and vodka? You know what I mean? And I was a mess. And I would try just to have a drink. And I've never had a drink. And I'd overshoot that mark. And I was terrified what I was doing to this little girl. And I had a priest bless the baby inside of me. And I had the holy water blessed by the Pope that I put on my stomach every day. And I'd have prayer services going on all over the country. And I could do all those things, but I could not stop drinking. And the day she came, I was terrified to have her because I didn't know what I did to that little girl. And my best friend came with me. And when the doctor went to hand me the baby, I wouldn't take her because I was scared. Because I didn't tell anybody I was drinking like that. And they handed her to my best friend. And when I see my best friend smile, I knew my little girl was okay. And I got to tell you, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew it. Every day I tried so hard not to drink. Every day I would try so hard just to have a drink, just to get the edge off. And of course, that never worked. So I knew I was powerless over alcohol, you know? And I knew my life was unmanageable. And my life has been unmanageable since kindergarten. And it's not all the states I lived in and the husbands and all the DUIs and all the everything I drank. I don't think it has anything to do with that. I personally think it has everything to do with what they talk about on page 52 of the Big Book. You know, my personal relationships were a mess. I was prey to misery and depression. I couldn't seem to make a living. I was filled with fear. You know, I had a feeling of uselessness. I couldn't seem to be of help to nobody. All that stuff was going on with me for years and years and years. And I could never put words to it, and I could never tell anybody that because I was afraid that somebody would lock me up, you know what I mean, because they would think I was crazy. So I got to tell you, it took me a lot of years to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, like it talks about on page 30 of the Big Book. And that first step for me had to be between me and God. And it took me 23 years to get there. So now I have these two little girls, and I have, now I get married to another hot dog vendor, you know what I mean? My two youngest daughters' father's chef. So he's an upgrade hot dog vendor, and he's a really good hot dog vendor, right? And they come in, they pack them up, they ship us off to whatever resort he's going to work at, and we get to wherever he was going to work at, and I never, ever wanted to be married. I never changed my name. I've always been Patty Burke. I've never changed my name. Never planned on staying married. And so we get to the whatever resort he was going to work at, and what I would do is I would, like, sleep with the whole kitchen staff. You know what I mean? I'm only kidding. Definitely didn't sleep with the old guys. And he'd be a little horrified, you know what I mean? And he'd send out his resume, and they come and they pack up my kids and him, and he'd go off, and I'd stay behind. And I'd play with the little boys until I started missing my kids, and I'd follow behind. And towards the end of my drinking, we live in Georgia, and I'm a complete wreck, you know? We own a restaurant now, and I tried to be a better mother to my two youngest daughters. I would show up to their school, and I'd carve pumpkins at Halloween and gingerbread at Christmas, and I'd go on class trips with them, and I'd be drunk out of my mind. And they were absolutely horrified and mortified by my behavior. And they started calling my little girls down to the office, and they'd be like, does your mom drink? And my little girls would say, my mom only drinks water, coffee, and vodka. And so then school was on to, like, my shenanigans. But my relationship with my husband was very abusive. And I just told you what kind of wife I was. You know what I mean? So I'm not thinking I'm a victim here. I suited up and showed up for everything in my world. But I know one thing, if I pushed him hard enough, or if he found out I was having another affair, he would either beat the daylights out of me, or he'd lock me in a room and scream at me for 3 hours and tell me what a piece of crap I was. And then he'd feel really bad, and he'd leave me alone for a week, and I could drink the way I wanted to drink for a week, and I was willing to take a beating to drink the way I wanted to drink. And towards the end of my drinking, we have this restaurant, and I'm having an affair once again with another young kid who works in our kitchen, and my husband's had it with me. And he comes home from work, and he drags me from the kitchen into the bedroom, and he gets on top of me, and he strangles me till I pass out. And I come to, and he said to me, Patty, if you're afraid of me, tonight's the night to be afraid of me, because I'm going to kill you. And I got to tell you, I seen something different in his eyes, and I knew he meant it. And he started strangling me again till I almost passed out, and he just fell off of me. And I got away, and I called the police, and the police came, and they arrested him, and they took him off to jail, and he had really high bail and all kinds of serious charges, you know. And I had these kids, and I had this restaurant to run, and it's Christmas time, and I am a mess. And I started thinking, what my problem really is Georgia. I think I got to get back to Jersey. Georgia's definitely the problem here, right? And so I was making my plans to get back to Jersey, and then the phone rang, and it was the police. And they said that my husband was bailed out of jail, and he was coming back home to pack up his stuff because I have a restraining order on him. And I figured, well, tonight's the night. I'm rolling tonight. And I stopped, and I got 100 proof bottles of vodka. And my plan was I was going to pack up the car and my kids, and I was going to head back to Jersey. And what happened is I came to, and my house was filled with the police, and it was filled with my neighbors. And my husband was not only packing up his stuff, but he was packing up my little girl's stuff. And the police told me that my little girls were better off with him than a drunk as a mother. And he had kidnapping charges, attempted murder, and attempted rape. And the, you know, the police were absolutely right, because every single day I would endanger my little girl's life. So I would drive in complete blackouts each and every single day. And I'd run over railroad tracks and I'd blow out the tires of my car. And my kids were terrified. Every single day I would do this. And one Saturday morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm already drunk. And I pull into the restaurant and I hit this tree. And my youngest daughter was 4 years old at the time. And she goes running into her father and she says to him, "Daddy, I'm so afraid. Mommy's acting really weird again. And she just fell asleep and she hit a tree. And I am so afraid." And I got into that restaurant and he started yelling and screaming at me. And what I did is I looked my little four-year-old straight in the eyes and I said to her, "See what you did?" Because I really believed everybody else was the problem. And my favorite speaker, he's from California, and he talks about how he comes to on a bus with his little girl, right? And she's crying and she's shaking and she's holding her stomach. And he says to her, "What's the matter, honey?" And she says, "Daddy, I'm so hungry. You forgot to feed me today." And so they stop at this rest stop, and he goes in and he gets a sandwich and he gets a bottle of wine. Anyway, and he gets up to the counter and he only has enough money for one, and he puts back her sandwich. And that's the kind of mother I was. And I got to tell you, I love my kids with all my heart and soul. And if you ever fuck with my kids, I will kill you. But if you put one drink in me, I will steal their food. And I knew he had nowhere to go with these little girls, so I left and I took off to St. Petersburg, Florida. And I was so relieved that they were gone. I was also really relieved that he was gone, because now I could drink the way I wanted to drink. You know, when it got to the point that I couldn't go 20 minutes without a drink because I would shake violently and my head and my heart would attack me so bad, I wouldn't know what else to do but just to take a drink because I would shake so bad. And I weigh 80 pounds and I'm bruised from head to toe and I'm yellow and I have long hair and it's falling out and I have bald patches all over my head. And I'm a mess and I have nowhere to go. And I wound up back in Georgia and I wound up moving into this crack hotel. And in the condition I'm in, I can't even work in the public anymore. And I wound up doing things I never dreamed I would ever do. Because that's not how I was raised. And every day was so hard for the things that I had to do for a bottle of vodka. And I just wanted to die, you know, because I couldn't believe where I wound up. And I didn't know women that drank like me. And I didn't know women that were doing the things that I was doing. Except somewhere I heard that people who smoke crack are doing the things that I'm doing. So I thought to myself, I better start smoking this crack. I might feel a little bit better about myself. So that's what I tried to do. I tried to smoke crack. And I don't know if any of you have ever smoked crack, but let me tell you, when you smoke crack, you get very paranoid, right? And I was way too drunk to smoke crack. I could not coordinate it whatsoever. There's pushers, all kinds of I couldn't do it, right? And so what the crackheads would do is they would smoke crack and they would hide and I would find them and they hated me. So you know you're in rough shape when you don't smoke crack and the crackheads even hate you. You know what I mean? They're like, just give her back her bottle. You know what I mean? So I tried to become a drug addict, but I was way too drunk to do that. You know what I mean? And they hated me, you know? And I want to tell one story that I hardly ever tell. So I come to, right, I come out of this blackout, right, and I'm in the hotel, right, with this big, big guy, and we have our shirts off, right, and we're sweating, right, and he turns to me, because I don't know how to smoke the crack, right, and he says to me, "I think you're an undercover cop," right, and mind you, I'm like yellow and 80 pounds and a mess, you know what I mean? And so he takes all his crack, right, and he goes into the bathroom and he flushes it down the toilet. And then he kicks me out of his hotel room. And I just didn't even know what was going on around me anyway. So I just went back to my hotel room and I figured I better shower if I was sweating and naked with this big black guy. You know what I mean? And so I come out of the shower, right, and I'm completely naked, right, and my hotel room is filled with police, right? And I was like, "Why, hello, boys." And they're like, "Why, hello, you're under arrest, right?" I must have wrote a bad check, right? So I'm laughing and cackling with the cops, you know what I mean? And so, like, I wasn't, like, a threat whatsoever. I wasn't resisting arrest. So they didn't even handcuff me, right? They're like, "Just get dressed." And so we go skipping out of the hotel, and I jump in the front seat of the cop car. And he's, like, peeking. You know how they peek? I don't know if you know, but they peek, right? He's peeking out the window, and he sees me laughing, getting in the cop car in the front seat, and he really thought it was an undercover cop. And he packed his shit, and he rolled that day, right? But anyway, so I lost the whole train of thought about my little story there. So anyway, so, like, I'm a mess, right? I'm a complete mess, and I cannot handle the things that I'm doing, right? And so across the street from this car dealership, this crack hotel was this car dealership, and the mayor owned it. And I had, like, this grand opening to my restaurant. I had, like, the priest bless the place, had the mayor cut the ribbon. So I went over, and I talked to the mayor, and he gave me a job detailing cars so I could be out in the parking lot, you know what I mean, drunk out of my mind, spraying hoses, seeing rainbows, you know what I mean? I didn't have to do those things anymore. And life really started looking good for me. I moved out of that crack hotel, and I moved into a trailer park, right? And things were looking up for me, right? And I came to work one day, and the mayor says to me, where are the keys to the van? I have no idea why I had them, but I did. And he said, I want you to grab something off the lot and go home and get those keys. So I grabbed a big red truck, and I went home, and I figured while I was there, I might as well have a few more drinks. Six drinks later, I'm like, oh, my God, I got to get back to work. So I start rushing to get back to work, and I come to, and the truck is totaled. And there's fire trucks and ambulance and all kinds of craziness going on. And they got me in the ambulance and they took me off to the hospital where they put 150 stitches in my face. And from there, they took me to jail. And that was my fifth DUI. And my father's trying to bail me out. And I just wouldn't come out because I really believed that the only way I could ever stay sober if I was locked away. Because without a doubt, the state of New Jersey sent me to AA. And I remember going to the meetings. I wasn't looking for a message of hope. I've been back to some of those meetings that I went to in Jersey, and there's not a message of hope there. So it was a good thing I wasn't looking for one. But I really believed, like, if you drank like me, you never stopped drinking. So I didn't really believe that AA worked, you know. I just really believed what I needed to do was just to be locked away for the rest of my life. And eventually my father bailed me out of jail. Now I'm at this trailer park, doing the same things I was doing in that crack hotel. And my world is small, and it's dark, and it's dirty, and I'm so tired, and I'm so lonely. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the loneliness that only another alcoholic knows. And what happens is the vodka stopped working. No matter how much it put in my body, it wouldn't stop my head anymore. And I gotta tell you, I have always, always prayed throughout my drinking. Because right after I got raped, I asked my mother, I said, Mom, why would God let this happen to me? And this is what my mom told me, because this is what my mom believes. She said, Patty, God's not punishing you. God's just making you stronger. So every time I'm making decisions based on self and put myself in the position to be harmed, I think I'm getting stronger to get to God. And God's so far out there that I would pray through the saints, and I would pray to St. Jude. He's the patron saint of hopeless and despair cases. And I would pray to him all the time. And this day, I just couldn't sell my soul one more day for a bottle of vodka. And I never wanted to give my kids away for a bottle of vodka anymore, ever again. And so I said a prayer to God. And I said, God, you got to help me because I can't get any stronger. And I know there's a God, because God's the only one I asked for help that day. And I took a bottle of Tylenol PM, and I drank whatever vodka I had left. And I came to on June 10, 2002 in intensive care. And I remember coming to, and the nurse that was in my room with me, she said to me, she said, and she must have been in AA, but I didn't know that at the time. She said to me, she said, if you stay sober from this day forward, this is a really awesome sobriety day. And I thought, she's just trying to make me stay sober. But meanwhile, it's Founder's Day, right? And so she said, but we don't think you're going to make it. So your father's flying in, and my father came in. Flew into Georgia because he thought he was going to have to take me home in a body bag. And they took all kinds of tests, and eventually it came back that I had no kidney, no liver damage, none of that. And they shipped me off to a mental hospital, not like a psych ward, like a whole hospital. I loved it there. Where they kept me there and detoxed me until I could stop shaking long enough so they can get me on a plane and get me back to Jersey, where my sister had a rehab set up for me. And I got off this plane, and my brothers were there, and they're looking at me like, oh my God, she's dying. And then all the bloat was completely off of me, so you can see every single bone in my body. And I was yellow and bruised, and I had the long hair with the bald patches. And I'm thinking to myself, they are so jealous of me. I look like a model, you know? And I am a mess, right? And I get to this rehab, right? And I'm terrified. And they want me to do workbooks and worksheets and stuff like that. And I lost the ability to read and write. And I was so embarrassed that I couldn't tell him I didn't know how to read and write anymore. And so I only have 7 days. That's all my husband's insurance will cover. So they're going to get me funding. So they take me up into the office, and they go through my workbooks and my worksheets, and nothing was completed. And they told me that I wasn't serious about recovery and that I needed to go. And I started to cry because I had nowhere to go. And I never wanted to go through another detox, and I never wanted to sell my soul or give my kids away ever again to drink. And I never wanted to feel that loneliness ever again. And I was willing to do whatever they wanted me to do. And what they wanted me to do is come to York, Pennsylvania, to a recovery house. And I didn't know what a recovery house was. I thought a recovery house was for women who get out of jail for murder. And they definitely will probably be beating me up, right? And so I get to York, Pennsylvania, and I walk into this house, and like I am like scared, and I tell you like the way I looked, right? And there's this girl who lives there, and she's on the phone. She stops dead in her tracks. She takes one look at me. She gets back on the phone. She's like, holy shit, this one's a real doozy. I think she has wet brain, right? And I am a mess, you know what I mean? And I'm like, oh my God, I got wet brain. I don't even know what it is, you know what I mean? I'm going to meetings. I don't know what everybody's saying. I'm like, oh my God, it's the wet brain, you know what I mean? I come back home to her. I'm like, are you sure I got wet brain? She's like, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure you got wet brain. She's like, not only that, everybody in AA is talking about you. And they knew like they were all looking at me, right? And she said, they're all calling you Skeletor, right? And I am a mess, right? And I'm like going to meetings and I don't understand what's going on. And I feel like I've gone too far for the things that I did. And then 14 and a half years ago, there was these people from Baltimore that was coming into York, AA with the big book. And they were destroying AA. And you weren't allowed to get a big book sponsor from Baltimore. And this was the first time I was serious about ever getting sober. And I was not going to be destroyed from these people, right? Right? I was doing this right. And so this guy introduces me to this lady who's not from Baltimore. And she's not using the big book. So I know I am safe, right? And so and I'm a mess, and I guess I'm about 45 days sober, and I'm getting worse by the days, and I'm throwing myself on the kitchen floor, and I'm screaming, and I'm crying, you know what I mean, and I'm like threatened to kill her, you know what I mean, and she said, what we got to do is, she said, you got to write down every single person you've ever slept with. I'm thinking, wow, do you know how many states I lived in? But I'm willing, you know what I mean, I'm willing to go to any lunch, you know what I mean, and so when I'm a mess, you know, and I just like want to kill people. I want to kill the people in the house. I'm in the 15 item or less to question me, my items. I'm having meltdowns, you know, a mess, you know what I mean? I start thinking like, I'm probably not even an alcoholic. I am probably just mental, you know what I mean? And so nobody would hire me either. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, I've owned restaurants and catering places and nobody's going to hire me. And I finally, right? But when you're yellow and you're 80 pounds and you're bruised with ball patches, nobody wants to hire you. You know what I mean? And so finally I get this job at Denny's, right? and I'm trying to think like, and I'm embarrassed. First of all, I'm embarrassed. I'm an alcoholic and I live in a recovery house. I'm never, ever going to tell a single soul in that place that I live in a recovery house and I'm an alcoholic, right? And I'm trying to think of all these, I'm trying to do this, like, think of all these people I slept with, you know, I'm a mess, you know what I mean? I want to kill people. And I'm standing at the hostess station with another server one Saturday, and in walks this guy from Jersey, right? And I turned to her, I said, oh my God, I slept with him, and I didn't put him on the list. She's like, oh my God, you keep a list? I was horrified. She's like, I was like, you don't? She's like, no, I don't. You know what I mean? And so I'm a mess, you know what I mean? You get the picture, right? You get the picture of what a mess I am, right? So I get together with this woman to do this fifth step, right? And this is what she tells me. She said that I've harmed nobody. The only person I've ever harmed was myself. And the reason I was the way I was is because I didn't bond with my mother, you know? And somehow I knew that she wasn't right, you know what I mean? And so I'm like really like threatening to kill her, you know what I mean? And so she says to me, she calls me one day, because she's probably like terrified of me. I was like a psychopath, even at 80 pounds, you know what I mean? Yellow, you know what I mean? She thought I was like the devil or something, you know? And she calls me up and she said, Patty, I think you need to get yourself a new sponsor because I think you have something different than I do. And thank God she did do that because I do have something different than she does. She's a problem drinker. She stops drinking and her life gets better. I'm a real alcoholic. I stopped drinking and my life does not get better. You know, and she had sufficient reason to stop drinking and she just stopped. Not me. I went to the very end, you know, when I couldn't even kill myself. You know, I had to do something different. I had to seek spiritual help. In the meantime, I started going to some different meetings, right? And I started hearing people talk about the hole in the soul. And that's how I felt like my whole life, like I had a hole in my soul. And I hear people talk about how they can walk into a room full of people and how lost and alone they felt. And that's how I have felt my whole life too. And I didn't know other people felt that way. I just thought it was me and I thought it was nuts, right? And there was this one lady, she absolutely glowed, and she talked about how she felt like the scum of the earth her whole life, and she didn't feel that way anymore, and she certainly didn't look that way. And I went up and I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths, and I said, absolutely. And she was said she was from Maryland, and she talked about the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I swear to you, I had no idea that the big book in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous was the same thing. And I had no idea that Baltimore was in Maryland. I might have had a touch of wet brain. Because if I would have known, I would not be sober today, right? And this is what she told me. She said, Patty, people have been telling you your whole life if you just stop drinking, you'd be okay. She said, and you stop drinking and you are definitely not okay. She said, drinking has never been my problem. Drinking has always been my solution. And now that my solution stopped working, what I needed was a new solution. She said, what I have is a spiritual malady, and what I needed was a spiritual solution. She said, we're going to work these 12 steps. We're going to lay aside anything I think I need and want. We're going to put it on the back burner, and she's going to teach me how to live this way of life. She said, everything in this world is going to come and go. The only thing everlasting is God. And she said, I must have a love affair with God, because there will come a day that the only thing that comes between me and a drink is God. And she said, I better have a strong foundation. She said, I was going to get up every morning. I was going to say that third step prayer. I was going to help as many people as I could that day. And if I couldn't help them, I wasn't to hurt them. She said, next, we're going to launch on a vigorous course of action. I was going to start writing a personal inventory. I already thought I did that with that sex thing, and I wasn't doing that. The only thing that proved to me that I was a whore, and I wasn't doing that again. Okay? But I was willing to do that. You know, I was willing to say the prayer. I got up every morning. I said the prayer. I go off to work. I was so helpful they had given me awards. I come back home. I was like the mother of the recovery house. I took care of the kids. I cleaned. I cooked. I did the shopping. I went off to a meeting, and I stuck my hand out to somebody who had one day less than me. And I come back home, and I'd scream, and I'd cry, and I'd kick, and I wanted to drink so bad. And everybody seemed like everybody was so freaking happy, joyous, and free, you know what I mean? And everybody seemed like their families were coming back. And I haven't seen my kids in over a year. And I called her up, and I said, this ain't working. I said, I want to drink so bad. I can't sleep. I have drunk dream after drunk dream. I said, I'm doing everything you're telling me to do. Meanwhile, I'm not writing an inventory. But I think I am, you know what I mean? And I said, and I miss my kids. And I said, and what I really just want to do is just hug my kids for 5 minutes. And she said, Patty, you don't have to physically hug your kids. God can hug them for you, and I want you to pray about that tonight. And that's what I did. I said that prayer, and I fell asleep, and I didn't have a drunk dream. I had a dream. I walked into a room, and all three of my daughters were there, and I could feel them hug me. And then somehow 2 days later, my middle daughter called me. She got my phone number somehow. I don't even know how she got it. And she called me, and I told her about my dream, and she said, oh, my God, Mom, I had the same dream. So if God could bring me and my daughters together in our dreams, God could do anything, and that obsession was finally removed. I did a fourth and fifth step out of the big book. Found out I was the problem. Couldn't believe it, right? And I also found out the sex conduct had nothing to do with sex. You know, it has everything to do with your personal relationships, you know. But what I did say is I seen exactly who I was in black and white. And I seen exactly how I've harmed everybody that I came in contact with. And that I have always been the problem. And so when I got together with her, I felt like crap. I felt like the worst person in the world, the worst mother, you know. And this is what she said to me. She didn't have to point any of that stuff out because I could already see it. And this is what she said to me. She said, Patty, the things you did when you were out there doesn't make you who you are. They're just things that you did. And she said, I probably needed to do what I did when I was out there and drank what I did. So when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never had to go back out. And she said, and all those dirty, disgusting things I thought I did when I was out there were going to be my biggest gifts to help other women. And she's absolutely right. I don't regret my past. I kind of hate the regret the husbands, but I don't regret my past. I get to help hundreds of men and women today, you know. And she sent me home to do 6 and 7 for the first time since I was 14. My head was completely silent, you know. And it, of course, didn't last, you know. When I reviewed those first 5 proposals, making sure I left nothing out, and I said that 7-step road, I gave it all to God, good, bad, right, wrong, I don't even know. I just gave it to God, you know. And I started writing my 8-step list, and I got to tell you, I harmed way more people that came off my 4-step. And as I'm writing this list, the state of Georgia is looking for me, and they want me back in Georgia for my 5th DUI. And for that truck I totaled. And so my sponsor, and looked like I was going to go to jail for a couple of years, so my sponsor said, we really got to get you through as many as amends as we can and get you through the steps, so when you get to jail, you'll be spiritually fit to carry this message. And she said, we'll start with the closest state, and we'll go back to Jersey, and you'll do so, as many as amends as you can in Jersey. And I couldn't wait to get back to do amends with my dad, because my dad's my hero, and I love him, you know? And so I get back to Jersey, and my dad knows I'm coming, and I try calling him in the morning, and he's not answering the phone, and finally I get in touch with my brothers. And my brother said to me that my father had a stroke that morning, and he was in critical condition, he was paralyzed, and he couldn't even talk. So I call my sponsor, I said, it doesn't look like I could do that one. And she said, oh, yes, you can. And she said, you ask everybody to leave the room. You don't tell them you're sorry. You've been sorry your whole life. You tell them you're wrong. And that's what I did. And my dad started to cry. And I said, Dad, you know what? There's a good chance I'll never be that person ever again if I continue doing the things that I'm doing. And my dad did manage to say the words, I love you. And he died about a week later. So my dad got to see me sober before he died. And it's almost like he held on, because my mother died when I was 25 years old from colon cancer. And my father has been a mess ever since, and I was like the mess of the family. And it was almost like he held on for me to get better so that he can go home to be with my mom. You know, when I got together with those hot dog vendors, my second husband said to me, he said, Patty, I really was going to kill you that night. The only reason I didn't kill you that night is because a bright white light came and hit me and knocked me off of you. And the whole time, I've always thought God was so far out there, and I've always been in the palm of God's hands. You know, and I got to go back to Georgia to go in front of this judge whose daughter was killed a year earlier by a drunk driver. And the mayor's mother was killed 10 years earlier by a drunk driver, so it didn't look good. And my grand sponsor, rest his soul, my grand sponsor taught me how to read and write, and I worked with him for 6 years. And I was with him every day and every weekend. We go travel and we do AA together. And he is like one of my heroes, you know. And I really believe that my sobriety wouldn't be what it is today if I didn't have that man in my life. And he died about 3 years ago in April. This April, he'll be dead 3 years ago. And my sponsor, he had two extra plots. So my sponsor brought the two extra plots and we're all getting married together. And we got a bench, right, with all our names on it. And on the bottom it says, in the final analysis, it's always been between you and your God. And then in front of it are stones, or headstones, right? And it says, Tom Flynn, pass it on. And the mime will say, Patricia Burke, and my sponsor just got it made. He's getting it made right now. And mine will say, sowing seeds of love. And his will say, Steve Farnsworth. And he's a pilot, you know, he's in the Navy, and he'll have wings on his, and it will say fly with the angels. And he said, if we pass it on, we sow seeds of love, and then we get to fly with the angels. So anyway, so Tom Flynn tells me, he says, Patty, he said, the judge, the lawyers, the prosecutors, nobody, none of those people are in charge, God's in charge. And if you're supposed to go to jail, that's where you'll go. And so I went in front of this judge, and what she gave me was 24 hours in jail. And I guess God thought it was best for me to carry this message outside the jails and inside the jails. And I had this suit on that my sponsor bought me. And they handcuffed me and took me out of the courtroom in my little suit. And on handcuffed me and threw me into a holding cell with another prisoner. And she thought I was a lawyer. I was like, nope. And so I went to jail for 24 hours. You know, I did. I talked about the 12 steps God in the big book, those 24 hours, because they didn't take AA meetings into the jails at that time. I really hope they do today. And I got back to York, Pennsylvania, which is the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and let me tell you something, I was on fire. I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and now that I was sober in York, Pennsylvania, people are going to get sober, let me tell you. I was like trying to take people you didn't even have to be alcoholic for me to try to take you through the steps, let me tell you. I was trying to take everybody in Denny's through the steps, because these people needed a spiritual awakening, let me tell you, right? And I got this apartment, it had high ceilings, and I got lumber, and I was going to build this loft, and I was going to start stacking the drunks, right? And what happened is, nobody stayed sober but me, right? They start stealing and all kinds of stuff, you know? And I had so much fun. That was really my favorite year of sobriety. Like, they robbed from me, you know? One of the girls disappeared. The drug dealer finally brought her back to me. She was like, like overdosing. I knew nothing about the heroin until I got to York, you know what I mean? And so I call the ambulance, they come in, they drag her, they shoot her in the heart, she comes alive, she's passed, you know what I mean? She comes back home, I'm like making her be sober. She doesn't want to be sober. And so I realized how I was making mistakes, what I was doing, I was denying that little girl her pain. So one of the hardest things I had to do was kick her out of my house and drop her off at a hotel, knowing that she's taking a prostitute herself out that night. And, you know, she lived with me for 5 years. She's been in and out of the room. She's like one of my kids, and I love her, right? And I get into my very first relationship. Where is our clock? Oh, okay, 15 minutes. So I get into my very first relationship ever in my whole entire life, even though I've been married, right? And I am, like, madly in love, right? And we're both in AA, and I'm like, Miss AA, you know, and life is so wonderful, you know, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm probably going to marry him, like, for the first time I want to get married, right? And what happens is I'm sponsoring so many people, and I'm traveling all over, and I start dying spiritually, and my relationship fails, and I run. And I can't possibly tell anybody in New York, Pennsylvania that I'm dying spiritually when I'm running around thinking I miss AA, you know what I mean? And so I roll, and I go to St. Petersburg, Florida. And I get there, and what I do is I jump in the middle of AA. And I do know one thing, nothing will assure immunity against a drink and intensive work with others when all else fails. And I start taking over AA in Florida, and people have like a lot of sobriety in Florida, and they're like, where the hell did she come from? And like, I'm like sponsoring all the homeless shelters, I'm rearranging meetings, starting conferences, you know what I mean? They're like, and I'm a mess, you know what I mean? I am a mess, you know? And I'm walking the beach, and then I get a call from one of the girls that I sponsor in New York still, and she says that my ex-boyfriend is sleeping with one of my 19-year-old grandsponsees, and my heart is shattered. And I'm like devastated, you know, my head and my heart are attacking me, and I'm just like praying. And so what I did is I regrouped, right? I regrouped up, and I came up with a new plan. And my new plan was, what I need is a brand new AA boyfriend. This time, what I need is not like an accountant that gets his nails done. I need like a manly man. Like, I need like a rugged, like, I need like a biker, like a powerful AA biker boyfriend. You know what I mean? That's what I need, right? And so I'm telling God what I need a week, and you know, and a week before I moved there, this guy from Cleveland, Ohio, the Mecca AA moves there, right? And I hear him in meetings, and he is powerful, right? And he calls me up, and he says to me, he says, Patty, you want to go for a ride on my Harley? And I'm thinking, oh my God, I am God's favorite. Yes, I want to go for a ride. You're damn right I do, right? So I go and meet him, and I jump on this Harley, and this big burly guy, you know, with my hair blowing in the wind, with the palm trees and the moon going over the bridges. And I'm thinking, oh my God, God definitely loves me the best. And we get all the way down to the beach, and he says to me, you want to get pizza? Pizza is absolutely my favorite food in the world. And I immediately know it is a sign from God, right? And so we get into the pizza place, right? And he grabs my hands, and he's looking me lovingly in the eyes. And I'm thinking, oh my God, he is probably going to ask me to marry him. And this is what he says to me. He says, because we're both in Florida for about a year. He says, Patty Burke, I've been watching the rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you are so busy, you're absolutely dying. And he tore apart the third step. And he showed me how I had to stop playing God. Why? Because it didn't work, and I wasn't in charge of the ex-boyfriends. The girls I used to sponsor, I wasn't even in charge of my kids, that God was in charge of them, and I had to stop playing God. And how I was still making decisions based on self. And and then he started talking to me about 10 and 11. Was I doing 10? Absolutely not. How could I do 10 when you were doing 10? I was making you do it, right? And so I know one thing, that God answers all our prayers, because God loves us so much. Me more, but God loves us so much, He answers all our prayers. And God did not send him there to be my new AA boyfriend. God sent him there to 12-step, because I wouldn't have heard it from anybody but a biker. And what he did is he took me back through the steps. You know, my head started to calm down. And my reliance had to be on God. Because as much as I wanted not to have, you know, put human powers, I just did. You know, I had all this faith in this guy. You know what I mean? And when he failed me, my relationship with God was rocky, you know, and I had to get this relation. I had to have the love affair with God, you know, and I came back to Jersey and I did a little tour of Jersey, took it over just a little bit, started a meeting. And then what I really knew I wanted to do is get back to York, because that's where I belong, because that's where my heart and soul is. And that's where I experienced everything for the very first time in my life. And so I finally made my way back to York, and I have this, my daughter, who's going to be 32 years old. She's a mess, and I have two granddaughters, and I don't know what kind of danger they're in, and I finally get her back into York. I finally get her to York with my granddaughters, and she's a mess, you know, and she sometimes sober, sometimes not, you know what I mean? And she says to me one day, she says, Mom, we're out of milk. You want me to take the car and the kids and go up to Walmart and get a gallon of milk? And she's sober, you know, and I was like, yeah. I think AA is working for her, you know what I mean? She goes off, she takes off at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, at 2:30 in the afternoon, to get a call from the state police. And they said my grandchildren were in Hershey Medical, and they won't tell me if they're dead or alive. And my daughter's locked up, and my car is totaled. And that I need to get to Hershey Medical immediately. And the road to get to Hershey Medical is the road that she caused all kinds of accidents, and it is hours to get there. And if my granddaughters are alive, they've never been around anybody they don't know. And I'm trying to rush to get there, you know. And I am a complete mess, you know. And I finally get to the hospital and my granddaughters are alive. But they won't let me see them because they think I allowed my daughter to drive drunk with my granddaughters. And I finally convinced them I did not. And I see my oldest granddaughter behind this sliding glass door. And I could see her and I can hear her. And she has her little hands over her eyes. And she's saying over and over again, I have no eyes, I have no eyes, because she's so scared and she doesn't know how to take her little self out of it. And they want me to become a foster mother, because now their mother's in jail. And I'm going to have toddlers. And so in the state of Pennsylvania, they go back 40 years into your past. Can you imagine? I've stabbed one of those husbands. Try to explain to the police, I just poked him really hard in the face. You know, they're like, we call that stabbing, you know what I mean? And so I had to jump through hoops, evaluated all kinds of stuff, you know what I mean? Fingerprint it, you know? And I still didn't even know if I was going to be a foster mother. And so, and if I'm not approved to be a foster mother, then my grandchildren go to live with a family they don't know. And finally I get the call and they approve me to be a foster mother. And they say, we usually don't let people with your background and alcoholics be a foster mother. But since you were so open and so educational about alcoholism, we're going to let you be a foster mother. And so I was a foster mother for 18 out of the 22 months. And in the next 5 years, I had custody of my grandkids. And my daughter would be in and out of our lives. And she would disappear. And when she'd come home, she'd steal everything. And she'd bring drug dealers into our house. And it was so scary. And when she'd be gone for weeks at a time, I didn't know if she was dead or alive. I didn't know if she was overdosed in some abandoned building or she was being held against her will. And I was a mess, and I couldn't eat, and I couldn't sleep, and I almost lost my job. Finally, I called her PO, and he wouldn't answer the phone, so I went into his office, and I sat there until he seen me, and I said, you have got to get my daughter and arrest her. And he did. Within 20 minutes, he had her locked up, and my daughter went to jail for 10 months. And I got to tell you, I slept every night, and I ate, and I didn't lose my job, and I got my grandkids on track and in school and updated, and they were in Alcoholics Anonymous, because in York, Pennsylvania, there's a lot of young people, so there's a lot of babies and there's a lot of babysitting meetings. And so my little granddaughters have been growing up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and let me tell you something, they have improved from 180 degrees. And of course, like, they're not like normal kids, you know what I mean? But because they will, like, instead of like paying school or something, they'll be like, you want to play AA? Get your big book. We're going to go do step work, you know what I mean? And they are the love of my life. And my AA was so different for 5 years, because I had to take care of my grandkids. And that's what God wanted me to do. God wanted me to take care of my grandkids, because God doesn't have grandchildren, you know? And so my AA was a little bit different, you know? And then my daughter got out of jail, and she was court ordered to an 18-month Christian program. And so she completed that Christian program. But the last year, my granddaughters were allowed to go live with her. And so July, my granddaughters and my daughter came home. And on May 25th, my daughter will have 3 years sober, you know. And they're back home with me. So I'm back being nanny and I'm like a full-time mom again, because my daughter's in school full-time now. And My life is so incredible, and my granddaughter's life is so incredible, and my daughter's life is incredible. Because let me tell you something. If I didn't get sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, my daughter would still be out there, and my granddaughters would be put in some foster home and probably adopted out by today, you know? And my two youngest daughters, they're a little bit crazy, and they're drinking, and they would come every summer. I never got custody of my daughters back because they never wanted to come back. But every summer they would come, and they go back to school. And one summer their father's getting sober, and when they leave to go back to school, they said to their dad, they said, "Can we go to a meeting with you?" And he's like, "Yeah, I guess yes. You go all the time with your mom." So they go to the meeting with their dad, and they say to their dad after the meeting, "They're doing it wrong here. That's not how they do it in York, Pennsylvania. What step are you on?" And they fired the sponsor. He wasn't going to take them through the steps, and they got him a sponsor who will. Because the deal is, my daughters know that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous works. Because they got a mother who's not a fallen down drunken slut today. They got a mother who will shoot up and show up for them any day. They need me. And summer after summer, they'd watch women come into our kitchens absolutely beat up and destroyed from alcoholism, and they'd watch these women go through the steps and watch them come alive. So if you do not believe Alcoholics Anonymous works, you can ask my kids, because Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I know one thing, if I was to die today and God would say to me, "Did you give everything away?" I would be able to say, "Absolutely, I gave everything away that was given to me, and that I've pushed as many people as I could to God. And I know that I've lived a successful life and tried to help as many people as I could. And I know I could do a lot more, so there's always tomorrow." Thanks for letting me share.